Our Dharma talk this evening will be given by Boundless Way Senior Dharma Teacher Bob Waldinger.
So, tonight on this chilly Friday night, I wanted to talk about this poem from Sung San that has coming and going in it. Sung San, as many of you know, was a great Korean Zen teacher who came to this country and started the Kwannon Zen School and many branches, many students. He gave Dharma transmission to George Bowman, who in turn gave Dharma transmission to David Reinick. So Sung San is David's Dharma grandfather. And there are a lot of things that are remembered about Sung San, but two in particular stand out for me. One is that he was a big fan of Dharma combat. And my hope is there won't be any of that tonight. And the other is that he really emphasized don't know mind. Phrase that's often connected with Sung San is just don't know. So what about this verse? Clear mind is like the full moon in the sky. Sometimes clouds come, yet the moon is always there. Sometimes clouds go, and the moon shines down brightly. Don't worry about clear mind. It is always there. Thinking comes and goes. You must not be attached to the coming or the going. Well, when I read this verse in a certain frame of mind, in my strategizing frame of mind, I think, okay, I get what he's saying. Just don't get attached to all the thinking, and the clarity will be there. It's something to do. It almost feels like an instruction. And boy, can I go for instructions. I have sort of a Zazen strategy of the month very often. I'll decide, you know, this month, I'm going to pay attention to my posture. That's really the key to my Zazen. Or I'm just going to receive. I'm just going to focus on receiving. And I'm sure none of you do any of this. But but what happens to me then is that the sort of the focus becomes an emphasis. And the emphasis becomes a story. And the story gets to be really ossified. And then something breaks it all apart. And I start all over again. And from that mind, the mind of Bob strategizing how to get those clear states of mind, this can feel like an instruction. But I don't think that's what Sung San is trying to say to us. Because he says, don't worry about clear mind. It is always there. I think he's pointing to the place where clear, cloudy, all that breaks down. Where what I think I know and what I think my goal is in Zazen begins to fall apart. And that's the place of aliveness. Often, for me, that place where things break down is when I'm really pushed to my edge. And, of course, the weather this last month has pushed many of us to our edge in many ways. On Monday, I was shoveling my driveway after the fourth storm in 3 weeks. And my neighbor across the street was shoveling her driveway. And at one point, she put down her shovel. She reached up to the heavens in a gesture of total submission and cried, uncle, uncle. You win. And for me, my edge came on Tuesday. Monday was the holiday, and Tuesday was my time to venture forward back into downtown Boston where I work. And I park in the parking lot of the Boston Garden, big arena that most days during the daytime is completely empty. And so people park there who work at my hospital. And it had been messy and gridlock for weeks, but I thought, okay, school vacation week, traffic is always much lighter. So I started driving down to my hospital, to my parking lot. And actually, I was looking at the clouds. The sky was blue and the clouds were beautiful. And everything was going great. And I thought, okay, I'm home free. This is good. And 9/10 of my commute was done and I was sailing. And then all of a sudden, I get right near the place where I park, right near the Boston Garden, 3 blocks away. And everything was completely jammed. And what I had forgotten was that not only were there extra parkers there because of the snow and the ban on parking on the streets, but it was school vacation week. And during school vacation week, hundreds, literally hundreds of preschoolers and elementary school children descend on Boston Garden for Disney on Ice. This year, the program was appropriately titled Frozen. So there I was, suddenly in a line of traffic that was going absolutely nowhere. And the wonderful thing is that the tradition is that the kids dress up to go to these performances. So there were all these little princesses with wands and tiaras and little gorgeous glittery boots and boys with lightsabers and armor. And they were all holding their parents' hands and trundling up. But there was gridlock. And I found myself sitting there with sirens blaring because ambulances could not get to the hospital, because there was gridlock, sirens blaring, parents yelling, and I found myself next to a minivan in the next lane. Neither of us was moving for about 15 minutes. But the man next to me driving his minivan was yelling. I couldn't hear him because our windows were closed, but I could see him yelling, screaming, and honking his horn. And of course, honking your horn was of no avail. I didn't know what he was yelling, but I think he was yelling the things that Kate saw written in the snow. But I noticed that in the back seat of that car was a little boy sitting in a car seat. And periodically, the little boy would peek over the side of his car seat, point his lightsaber at me, and vaporize me, and then go back and hide in his car seat. And I realized that we were going nowhere, so I put my car in park, and the next time he shot me, I collapsed onto the steering wheel. And he got totally engaged. We were in combat. We were having our own Dharma combat. Then I shot him through the window, he shot me back, and we were back and forth, back and forth. In the meantime, the father had no awareness that this was going on. He was yelling and honking the horns, and sirens were blaring, and people were stepping in puddles. And I sat there, realizing that this was my edge. I was as frazzled as I had ever been. And here was this adorable little boy playing a game with me. Where was the moon? Where were the clouds? Where was the clarity? All of it, just one swirling mess, arising and falling away in each moment. Everything broken down and very much alive. I think that Sung San is pointing to that place, not the place of instructions, but the place of not knowing. where clarity, confusion, clouds, moon, no separation, all one big thing. And when I'm really honest with myself, I realize that what I want is not some permanent, clear view of the moon. What I want is a sense of aliveness, of really living my life, of being fully present for as much of my life as I can be. And those injunctions that we give each other and that our teachers hand down to us through the ages, do not squander your life. They're not have clarity all the time. See the beautiful moon in every moment. No. It's bring awareness whenever you can to each moment. And we can bring that awareness to honking horns and sirens and screaming and excited little boys. And we don't need any special place to do it. We don't need to be in a monastery. We can be in a traffic jam. We can be lying awake sleepless at the temple. That image of the moon is used by our teachers a lot as an image of realization, an image of enlightenment. And I'm reminded of the little koan that's at the near the beginning of the Blue Cliff Record, where Yunmen asks his monks. He's talking about the lunar calendar, and the lunar calendar in ancient China was set up such that the full moon, the moon waxed up until the 15th of the month, and then it waned to nothing by the end of the month, and then waxed again. So Yunmen asks his monks, he says, I'm not asking you about before the 15th of the month. I'm not asking you about when the moon is growing and realization is developing. What about, say something about after the 15th of the month, when things are waning, when the moon is disappearing. And then the koan is very clear that Yunmen doesn't wait for any of the monks to answer. He jumps right in and answers for them. He says, every day is a good day. Seeing the moon, not seeing the moon. Thinking, not thinking. Delusion. All one big thing, and all subject to the aliveness that comes with bringing awareness to each thing that arises. We also talk in our tradition about life and death. The injunction is not to squander life because it's hard to guarantee even a morning or an evening. And just before I came here yesterday, a friend sent me a link to a New York Times article that was published yesterday that spoke to exactly this. It was by Oliver Sacks. Some of you may know who he is. He's a neurologist. And he's written some wonderful books. One called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and one called Awakenings. And they're about people with very unusual neurological disorders. But what he does so masterfully is he shows how these disorders teach us about not just the brain, but about what it is to be human and to have a human life. Well, Oliver Sacks published this article yesterday about what it was like to learn that he's dying. He just learned, feeling like he was in great health, that the cancer of 10 years ago has come back, that it's advanced, that there's nothing to be done, and that he will die soon. And what he wrote about in that piece was a sense of feeling more alive than ever, a sense of bringing vivid clarity and attention and focus to what he's doing, because there's no time for anything that's not essential, as he says. And he ends his piece with what I think could be a coda to both Yunmen and Songsan. After talking about all that he wants to do and be with his loved ones and travel and keep talking with people who he loves to talk with, he says, "I cannot pretend that I am without fear, but my predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I have been given much, and I have given something in return. I've read and traveled and thought and written. Above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet. And that in itself has been an enormous privilege and adventure." Oliver Sacks and Yunmen and Songsan are all reminding us that this is an enormous adventure. That we don't need clarity in every moment. That we don't need anything except to shine the light of awareness on whatever arises. And the good news that Songsan so kindly leaves us with is, don't worry about clear mind. It is always there.
So I invite you to sit comfortably and come forward with your questions, observations, comments.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Derek.
I would like one too. But I noticed that I can use it as a story. Like, oh, this is, this period of my life, this week has been, the moon is growing. And this period of the week, the moon is, decreasing.
Yeah.
And just to notice that, come back to, what's here.
Yeah.
And forget about the story.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me, I learned something, that in fact the human mind not just makes stories, but it makes faces. That if we're given pretty random patterns, we will find a way to make a face out of it. And so this is just, it's just what we do. And not really a problem.
But it sort of occurred to me, and I use this term just like you all the time, it's like at my edge. And it just occurred, on the edge of what? Like, what is on the other side of the edge? Spontaneously self-combust.
That's it. That's it. Yeah.
What is that?
Right.
It's a story, but how do you know? I mean, is it just. Does the edge move? I mean,
I think you've hit it for me, at least. I think it's that the edge is, I'm at this place of not knowing. I'm at this edge of don't know, of falling off the cliff, of...
One of the images I've heard for that is the image of someone hanging on to a tree branch and, they don't want to let go because, I'm going to die, I'm going to fall. And you let go, and it's an inch down to the ground. Yeah. I'm going to die, I'm going to die. Oh. Yeah.
Your story of being in gridlock reminded me of my gridlock story. I don't know if you've ever heard it before, but I've told it a number of times because it was just so amazing to me. Again, it was Boston traffic.
Yeah.
And there was a period in my life when I was commuting from Worcester to Boston, thankfully only one day a week. If I left at 6 in the morning, I would get where I needed to go at 7:30. If I left at 7, I would get there at 10, and I needed to be there at 9. So I would just leave as early as I could. But one day, I was on the getting off the Mass Pike on my way to the expressway. I don't know if you've ever been there. There's many roads coming in at the same place, and you have to kind of cross over. Some people are going north, some people are going south. I was coming east. And I went through the toll, and everything stopped, just like you talked about. And I knew I was going to be late for work, and you know, was upset and frustrated. I think you were. And it was just like this mass of cars, and I looked around at all the cars, and I was very angry. And people were honking, and then I caught the eye. Oh, I decided to meditate because you get your car in park.
Yeah,
and just like what are you going to do? It's going to be here for hours. So I just you know, loosened my grip on the steering wheel and smiled and just breathed. And then I caught the eye of somebody in an adjoining car who was looking at me like, what? And I looked up at her, and we just started laughing. And then she caught somebody else's eye, and that person started laughing. And finally, there must have been hundreds of people laughing. And there was somebody, the one person who could make the gridlock disappear, who was gestured at by somebody else, go, go, and it suddenly disappeared. It was I still feel like it was a miracle, and it had something, you know, like think of the little boy playing, trying to kill you over and over and over.
Yeah.
There's this feeling of playfulness in the universe that's palpable.
Yeah.
And I went from frustration to giving up to delight in the space of, I don't know, it was really 10, 15 minutes. And so did everybody else, apparently. And that's like, that's the sun. You know, that's the sun that's covered over by clouds. The clouds were, I got to get to work. Everybody's in my way. Life is terrible. You know, hate the snow. But then suddenly it's, oh, human beings.
Yeah.
It was kind of an amazing thing. I had a really good day at work that day. Mm-hmm. And then I left that particular job.
Yeah. I love that, and like you can almost feel yourself physically let go.
Yes,
you know, just there's something about both the physical and the mental holding on to this tight story of gotta get through, gotta, you know, and then it's like, ah.
And the first thing I felt was how tightly I was holding the steering wheel. That's sort of what we've been talking about. You know, that first you have to feel the tightness before you can move on.
Thank you, Bob. I was listening from around the corner there because I was late because of traffic. That was a beautiful story. And, you know, out there, people are getting really upset, as you know.
Yeah.
So it is a big contrast to kind of come from this, you know, environment here and then go out where people are, like, yelling at me and honking at me, which did happen on the way here, actually.
Yes,
you
yes.
know? And just being aware of that, you know, and it's quite a nice thing to be able to come back here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you very much. It's lovely. Yeah.
Well, and you know, I think it's in some ways it's the awareness that seems to lice it. Like once, like not a problem that we all do this. I mean, everybody, you know, we're human and we just do this and we get all angry at each other and people actually come to blows about parking spaces and the snow and stuff. And, but it's the awareness, it's that moment when it's like, oh, we're all here, we're all doing this, when suddenly... suddenly it's just a 1-inch drop. It's not, my God, I'm at my edge.
Yeah. And it's so wonderful when that happens, you know, like well, so I parked in this place, and the person was having trouble backing his truck out, and he got out and yelled at me for parking in the place. Yeah. And I said, well, there was somebody parked here, so I had to park there. He goes, oh, well, that explains it. So it's just so wonderful when that happens, you know, and something happens, you drop it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, so how we do that ourselves and can enjoy when other people do, too.
Yeah, I loved your car story as well. I was just at a celebration of my dad's life, and that kind of playfulness is what people remembered about him, like a story of, you know, somebody following him to a certain place where they were going to go different ways, and before they left, he pulled up next to them and, I guess, had a bag of peanuts and threw it actually out the window, and the first bag went right through both of their roll-down windows and out the next side, and then he threw another one, and they had thought to roll up the other window and actually get to keep the peanuts. But just the lightness that, you know, breaks through, because we all, you know, take things so seriously, and as his son, I'm guilty of taking things too seriously, but how I loved being in his presence and all that playfulness cutting through, you know, my seriousness. It was a real gift.
Yeah. Thank you. So, you know, these stories of traffic, I mean, it had...
I think I touched a chord.
Yeah. It's interesting how, you know, those moments of tension, I mean, can really... illuminate how I hold on to the story of what's important. Like, I have to be there on time, and there's the story, right? That, oh my God, you know. So it's interesting how that kind of frustration and anger is just, you know, it's just the story.
Yeah.
You know, that you have to be somewhere or something is.
Yeah.
You know. And so then, you know, sometimes you have these moments where in the middle of it, you're like, oh.
Yeah. You know,
like it's okay. You know? Because I've done that stuff coming here, you know. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Coming to meditation.
The only speeding tickets I've ever gotten in my life have been on the way to meditation. Yeah. I don't know what that says, but you know, did you have more to say?
No, that's basically just how that arising. You know, if you notice, you can start to see the story behind it.
Yeah. And the sense of, it has to be this way. It can't be any other way. You know, one of my psychoanalytic teachers was fond of saying, the graveyards are filled with indispensable people. You know? And we, you know, at my hospital, they send out emails saying, if you are an essential person, then you have to be here. And that's like, well, am I? Do I want to be an essential person?
On 9/11 at the office where I worked, we got an email like, all non-essential personnel should leave. And we all looked at each other in the office and said, I think we're non-essential.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, our boss said, nope, we have a meeting, we need to stay. I was really touched by your... by the quoting of Oliver Sacks, that especially the end there, because it's very much related to what Aaron was just saying. You know, that when you really are faced with what life is all about, things you see what's essential and what's not essential.
Yeah.
You know, and these stories we make up about gotta do it, gotta be there. Those are like the clouds. I mean, they're unavoidable, but
you know, and. I'm grateful to this practice for many things, but one of the things I'm grateful for is that we don't have to get terminal diagnoses in order to pay attention to this. You know, because you see so many people who, seriously, who really begin to focus for the first time sometimes when they realize their time is suddenly much more limited than they thought. And we're doing this to ourselves all the time.
Well, and part of our chants are remembering our terminal diagnosis.
Yeah. You
know, right. It's just a matter of time.
Yes.
But to bring that to awareness, then yeah. we can live in some way.
Yes. A very famous Zen teacher, David Reinick, once said to me, someday we're all going to be deinstitutionalized.
There's one other Oliver Sacks story I have to tell, which is I heard him interviewed on the radio on one of these blog kind of things, and the person was asking him about his routine, and he said, well, on Tuesday I have lentil soup, and I have exactly this much, and I have 3 tomatoes, and then on Wednesday I have tuna fish, and I get exactly the same thing every week. And the guy said, well, that's actually a little weird, isn't it? And he said, yes, it is. And the guy said, well, you know, don't you feel bad about that? You know, here you are, this famous neurologist, and you're so uptight. And he said, oh, yes, I feel terrible about it. But that same spirit coming through. There's some real freedom. Oh, I feel terrible about it.
You know, I'm visiting here from Seattle, staying for a while, and I have really been enjoying the misery that you all have. I just think it's so human that all of the Dharma talks we have been around, I think almost all of them have been around, oh my God, the snow. And what it does to us, you know, we humans who have to deal with this sudden adversity, and it either makes things worse for us because of all these people, or it makes things better because of all these people, because then we've got compadres, you know, people who are suffering with us, and then you make the most of it, or you make the best of it that you can. And I just think it's a wonderful thing, the craziness, the unusual circumstances that bring us together, and or drive us apart for that matter, but that really make such a difference in our life and in our lives when those odd circumstances come up. So I appreciated your comment about, yeah, we seek this out even as Zen students, but it's just interesting that regular life. And then, you know, we're all in this kind of heightened awareness with the weather right now. And then what happens when it goes back to regular life?
Yeah. You know, one of the things you brought up is so important, which is that, you know, we can suffer with each other and it eases so much. And if you think about it, the stories, like the story Melissa told, the story I told, to some extent are about making contact in the midst of isolation, in the midst of suffering alone. And that when we make the contact, so much gets eased.
Well, in this place of at the edge, this impasse is terrible and full of possibility. You know, and in some ways our retreat, the sesshin, is designed to bring us to an impasse.
Yes.
You know, where our stratagem doesn't work anymore and things is normal, and it's in that interruption we think is a bad place, but I think as we go through it again and again, we begin to see this is the only possibility for breaking out of the tyranny of our story. You know, only when we're at the edge, when we cannot maintain it anymore, or something interrupts us, someone yells, we can't get what we want, then we can see what's around us.
I used to teach kids with autism, and I don't know if I really agree with that, what you just said. Because one of the things that was really important to me was that, I mean, I had a lot of sort of tricks in my bag to work with kids, but the one that I used the most toward the end of my practice was playing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I realized was that really nobody has to play back. And, you know, I don't know if anybody knows of Stanley Greenspan. He's this sort of, now he's become this sort of guru for autism, but he didn't start out like that. He was just a regular psychiatrist who worked with kids in preschools, and not even kids that were necessarily labeled with anything. And he said, if you come across a child who doesn't respond when you reach out, don't assume they didn't like it. They just don't know how to respond. And really, it's because we have this assumption that this sort of way of how things are, and I think this is how Oliver Sacks, all of his books, teach you this, that really we have this assumption that this is the healthy way, this is the way everything works. But honestly, it just doesn't. And, you know, that's why I'm not sure if you really have to have these. I'm not saying that Sashin isn't indispensable or anything, or any of these other things that bring you to the edge. But really, when you're playing, you come to that edge all the time. I loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, I miss it so much. Mm-hmm. Because it's that, like, the thing where what you're doing is, it makes it possible for you to put aside everything else, because it's just this unbelievable, intimate interaction with someone that maybe they're very different from you, but they're a lot more like you than a squirrel, you know, or, you know, any art chair or something.
Well, you know, one of the things you're reminding us to do, I think, is to bring don't know mind even to our assumptions about how Zen works, how Sashin works, how all these things we're saying about how human beings are, because you've been, you and Oliver Sacks have been on the edges, you know, working with people who see the world very differently and operate very differently. And you're saying, don't forget these people in our stories we tell about how things
and are. And I remember it during Nokusan every time. Yeah. Then I feel like I'm trying to know this reality that you're offering me. And I'm like, well, I hope they know that I really want it, even though I don't know.
We know. I can say it for myself. And I was exactly, I was thinking as you were talking, Deb, about you playing with the children with these different labels and labels of autism and various other things, and that they don't. This is how I feel in Doksan. I don't expect people to play back. It doesn't matter. But I do know that they're more like me than squirrels.
Sometimes I'm not so sure.
David has a different
squirrels.
Cheers. But there's also this understanding that I have that people who, not everyone comes to a Zen center or a temple or Sashin for that matter, but the people who do, and then the people who take the big risk to go to Doksan, which is really scary, I've heard from other people, and I remember that from when I was, it's really scary. You have to show up in front of this person who plays different from you, and you have to learn what they're asking, and, you know, really working with koans is partly learning how to play in a very particular way, and it takes a long time to learn how to do that. That's right. It's very playful, and Shikantaza is also very. There's no way to explain how to do Shikantaza.
I've never found, everybody finds their own way in that too. So this whole thing, this Zen enterprise, is about playing with and waiting for some response. It might be just, I'm out of here, that happens. But sometimes it's like, oh, and then, you know, and then these Dharma dialogues too, I think it's the same way. They're these little revelatory moments. Or just listening to a talk. They're these little moments. We ask not to listen to try to understand, but to listen with the heart. That's why we do it from within our zazen, rather than, you know, thinking, what's he saying now? Oh, yes, I can pull this theoretically together. Instead, like, whomp. We get whomped. I got whomped by Bob's talk a couple of times.
And also, another thing that it reminds me of in this realm that I miss it a lot, but when I was teaching, I used to also realize how little tolerance I had for people who weren't different, who were the same. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I would walk out of usually some room with the session with some child, and then I'd walk out and everything would seem very flat to me. And I used to say to myself, now why can't I have the same curiosity and the same openness, you know, to the secretaries and the principals and the, you know, all the other institutionalized, so to speak, things.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't really mean to say that Dokusan or, you know, Sashin isn't a great thing. I mean, that's why I come here, but I'm really just so fascinated by the expectation of things that seem to need to be there to create a crisis, when really... if you're playing, that edge is really, it's always there.
Yeah.
You just don't always have permission to play.
Yeah, and what I want to pick up on in what you're saying is that one of the things that I think is true for all of us is that we all have some place or some experience in our life, like you're talking about your being with these autistic children. You know, for some of us it may be gardening, for others it's, you know, different things. But this place is the place of practice. And you're right, it's not about manufacturing some crisis or doing anything. It's not even about being in the Zendo or not being in the Zendo. So thank you for bringing all this richness in and reminding us how important play is in that spirit. So.
And not all Zendos have so much play either.
Right.
It hurts.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, go ahead, Steve.
I was really struck by when Deb was speaking about this. You know, so we do come to Sesshin and push ourselves to that edge, you know, and we hold so tightly to our stories of, you know, of what's important, and it takes a lot of pressure to break through that grip, you know, and we put ourselves in that situation, and we see, oh, you know, I can let go of this story, you know, I really am only in this case falling an inch, right, and it makes it so clear, you know, that these stories that we hold on to are things that we create ourselves, you know, and as I think Deb was pointing out, it isn't actually necessary to push ourselves to the edge in order to let go of these stories, you know, that if we can bring some lightness, you know, to ourselves, and your story of being in traffic, I think, illustrates that wonderfully, you know, that suddenly, you know, everybody's so uptight about getting where they're going, and then suddenly, you know, there's just this shift, or what Melissa was talking about, there's just this shift, and it didn't take, you know, being pushed to that hard to the edge in order to let go of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a real possibility of that we can. Unfortunately, I don't seem to experience that a whole lot. But there is this possibility of
stop bragging.
It's not. But there is the possibility of not needing to be pushed that hard. And so this is part of my experience, that if you hold on really, really tightly, you know, it takes a lot to dislodge you. But after you put yourself through that and you see it clearly, that it's easier to let go sooner. You know, and I think that's why we have these reminders that you were talking about our death and all that we don't actually have to have a terminal diagnosis in order to realize that how precious life is, and that maybe we can let go of some of these stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
So hold on, Deb. We're going
to. Well, I was just going to say, I think, you know, I think it's the difference between the inch drop and the 1,000-foot drop, because I think when I'm holding so tightly to one of my stories, the energy behind that holding on is because it seems to me like it's going to be such a free fall and so terrifying to let go of it. And that I'm and so I think what you're saying is we need the experience of falling that inch and going, oh, and then holding on again and then falling again.
I want to just change the topic slightly because there's another. Let me see if I can connect to this a little bit. But it was triggered by something that you said, Janine, which I think is part of this whole thing. So we all have a terminal diagnosis. I just want to clarify that. This is not every single person in this room has a terminal diagnosis, and we can ignore it for most of our lives. But then events happen that make us not able to ignore it. And one of the first piece of the Eightfold Path of the Buddha is right view or aligned view. And that view is a bigger view. It's a view of all of the elements. It's like a reminder that we're going to die. It's a reminder of what's important. And the reason it got triggered by what you said is because I was checking the weather, because, you know, it's become a thing here, right? And this is very unusual weather, you should know, coming from Seattle. We don't get weather like this. Mm-hmm. This is why it's so unusual. That's why we're obsessed with it. And then this article on weather.com said that the people in the Northeast are feeling oppressed, like that woman saying, uncle, uncle. But the people in the West are jealous because they're not getting any snow in the Sierras. And that means that the drought, which has been horrible, is going to get even worse, unimaginably worse. Mm-hmm. So they wish they were getting all this snow, and they're getting all this heat, and we wish we would get the heat, so this Arctic blast. In the big view, you can almost see how the whole planet, this isn't going to get better. And so there's some way to have that big view and realize, wow, it's not just me who's terminal. It's like the whole thing is terminal. And how am I going to live now in the middle of that knowledge? That it's going to seem like it gets better, and then something else is going to happen. And that's just going to keep happening and happening and happening. So there's some way of having that large, expansive view that is just what we were talking about in the traffic stories, and it's just what Oliver Sacks was talking about, that what's really important. So you can lose your mind in all these speculative things, but all we know is this. All we know is us, here, right now, really devoted to waking up. And that's all we can do. And then some of us, because it's a coming and going, says she, go out into the world and get yelled at. and that's it too.
Yeah.
You know, there's so that's it. Then when you're getting yelled at, that's what's here. And when you're stuck in the snow, that's what's here. When you're stuck in the drought, that's what's here. So it's this constant, you know, and just connecting it back to Yuen Men for a moment. And that's also a good day.
A good day.
But not in the sense of yippee.
Yeah.
Sometimes yippee.
Yeah. Well, so let's continue to practice this.